Welcome. It's Thursday already. Boy, the days are moving fast. We're going to open the work session on Senate Bill 96. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill was heard on January 22nd. It would allow, the original bill would have allowed the Construction Contractors Board to set the fee for their home inspector competency test by rule. The amendments, the dash one amendments that you should have at your place, would instead cap the testing fee at $150. The current cap is $50. Mr. Chair, the amendments were worked out between the Construction Contractors Board and the home inspectors, and Craig Smith is here. Do you have any questions?
Please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board, and the Dash 1 amendments before you, as your administrator has indicated, are something that we worked out with the home inspection industry. Originally, what the Contractors Board wanted to do was to outsource the testing of home inspections to a national company. And there are several states that do this. We provided Ms. Adkins with a copy of that. The costs range anywhere from around $85 up to $225. We had anticipated we could do this for around $200, but the industry would prefer to keep this testing in Oregon. They do not want the Contractors Board to do that. And so an alternative is to keep it in-house and to try to raise enough revenue so that we could professionalize this test. We believe that we could do that if we raise the test a maximum of $150. And we've got a plan to try to hire some testing professionals to perfect this test, and thus the Dash 1 amendments before you. Can I answer any questions?
Thank you. Let's see. Any questions from the committee? I know it's been about a month since we had this before us. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, the original bill allowed the department to set the fee by rule. That's now been capped, so that the rule, so they can't just keep raising the fee. Is that correct?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, that's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much. So we're in work session on Senate Bill 96 with a Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment, Senate Bill 96.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 96. Any objection? Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 96 as amended, Senate floor, to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 96 as amended for the do pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Mark Senator Deckard as excused. And let's see. Senator Monis Anderson, why don't you carry that bill?
Sure.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 551. And has Senator Przanski come in yet? No, but let's ask Squire, you want to come forward and get us started?
Sure.
And if you have anybody else, bring them up, and otherwise, we'll start with you.
We have another gentleman, two. We got four.
Okay. I'll let you orchestrate your panel. You're experienced at this, I know.
How you doing?
I'm doing great, Commissioner. Good to
for
see
the
you.
Record, I'm Bill Dwyer, County Commissioner, Lane County. This is my neighbor, Rosemary Harris, and a friend and neighbor, Jim Parker. Rosemary's husband was lost in a maritime accident, which was on the Sydney May. And Jim was on the boat. Him and the captain survived. They held on to the same life jacket. The captain was warned not to go across the bar. It was dangerous. It was 18 or 19 foot plunging waves. He was told to go to Charleston and not attempt to cross the bar. He didn't even, this was a commercial vessel that took money for the trip. The day before, my neighbor, out in the yard, some of the kids had stole some corn and stuff, and so I went out and I met with him, and he says, "Hey, I'm going fishing tomorrow. Do you want to go with me?" And it was a Friday, and I had a couple meetings, and I said no. So conceivably, I could have been on that boat. I didn't know that they were going tuna fishing. And they probably didn't know either, because when you're down there, it's an opportunity kind of a thing. So the captain has subsequently been convicted of several counts of manslaughter. He goes for sentencing on April the 2nd. I spent a lot of time at my own boat. These are dangerous waters. The captain never even told these people where the life jackets were. And you're fighting for your life. I mean, not only should a life jacket be required, but a strobe light ought to be attached to each of them, because in the ocean, without any way for them to identify where you are, they're not going to find you. And that's the only thing that saved them. And it's pretty hard to regulate stupidity. And Janet tells me, well, the Coast Guard called and they said the bill may be preempted. You know, the Coast Guard's had the authority to regulate these things for a long, long time. They've done nothing. Every time there's a meaningful solution that comes forward, they don't even have the guts to come. They call up their committee administrator and say, hey, you know what? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get a hold of DeFazio, who's my neighbor, who happens to be the chair of their appropriations, some of their stuff, and I'm going to make them either do something or keep their mouth shut, because I think it's ludicrous that people pay money, put their lives in the hands of people who are supposed to be cognitive about the dangers of the sea, and you put your life and your trust in them and you don't come back. So as a result, I have a widow that has a family and children. I lost a good hunting and fishing buddy, and I know others just in this past year that I've lost too, just because of stupidity. So I think this bill is a no-brainer. I would hope that the state would take the lead in this, because we're talking about the waters to the bar. We're not talking about international waters. And I, as a county commissioner, I could do it at the county level and have an ordinance, but I'd much rather the state to do it. And so we have some consistency, because these deaths are occurring from Gold Beach to Astoria. They're not just in Winchester Bay or in, they're all over. So I'll let Rosemary and I'll let Jim. I'll let start with Jim. Jim Parker, tell him, Jim.
Welcome. Yeah, I'm Jim Parker. I was aboard the Cindy May. On that trip, we were indoctrinated with any kind of safety apparatus at the time we left the dock or any other time on that trip. And the captain, he was told 6 times by the Coast Guard. In fact, on the last call, which he hung up on the Coast Guard and apparently instructed to go to Charleston. And when the wave hit, the captain had his own life jacket, and after being in the water, after the boat sank, my life jacket floated to the surface out of the cabin, and that's how I received mine. And when I swam to the captain, which was in the water, he instructed me that there was a strobe light in my life jacket. And I know at that time, if that light would have been on, because of the people who were on the hill at the lighthouse, that they might have seen that light and instructed the Coast Guard if somebody were in the water. It was 45 minutes before they rescued us, and it was an imperiling night for all of us, and I lost a really good friend in Bill, which was unaccountable for, because of his instructions just to go to Charleston, and this rule that the captain has designation over his patrons and in his crew, which he failed, and as a law of wearing a life jacket as you enter the ocean, I'd see would be beneficial for all fishermen or people that enjoy fishing on the Oregon coast. And and the commercial fishermen that make a living there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll hear for our next witness.
Hi, I'm Rosemary Harris. I have a son and daughter, and my husband did die on this particular fishing boat, Sydney May 2. And the captain did not listen to the Coast Guard, and I feel totally that was a useless accident. Innocent people died, and it's all because I think that a law has got to be put in place that all fishing boats, charter or otherwise, when you cross the bar, you need to be wearing a life jacket. It's your choice if you take it off after you get out there, because the ocean is sometimes just like a sheet of glass. I've been there myself. My husband and I own a boat. We've fished the ocean many times, and we've gone out on every bar in Oregon. And I happen to know that Winchester Bay, for this example, is a very rough bar. The one coming in from Portland is the worst. But I do think that everyone should be at least told to wear mandatory. Make it a mandatory thing that they just wear a life jacket when they cross any bar, may it be Washington or Oregon. We have rough bars here, and we know it. Everybody knows it. Lots of friends are not going to be supporting boaters or commercial fishermen or charter boats if we do not put a law into effect, because people are scared to go out. Because since my husband's accident, there's been several on the coast. And I don't believe most of those people were wearing life jackets either. We're just losing lives of young people that shouldn't be. They're healthy young people. I work in a hospital atmosphere. I work in an operating room. I know what can happen if you don't take safety precautions. And that's all we're asking. The choice should be from when they board the boat to when they get out in the ocean. Then, once they're across the bar, the choice could be theirs. I don't think that's too much to ask. Coast Guard or any boat person, you know, of any captain of any boat. And that's about all I have to say. It's unfortunate. I lost a very healthy husband who was just in the prime and just retired of 5 years, and he shouldn't have died out there. He had a safety, I'm not going to name the brand name, but he had a safety vest on. But when you're in the ocean all night for 8 hours or more, and in the rough bar, and the conditions were extremely rough, he was without a shirt when he was found. So everything slipped up and over him. And I think that all of these people that did die in this particular incident could all have been saved had they had a life jacket on. Thank you.
One further comment. It's interesting that when this happened, one of the captains made a derogatory comment about, oh, it'd be too expensive. You have to have life jackets on. They'd wear them out. That's pretty interesting. And they're totally unnecessary. The sad part about it is that captain was a victim. His boat sank. He didn't have his life jacket on. So he was a victim of his own ignorance. I'm not one for mandating what people do. I often said in the year 2000, I kind of wrote a statement that said the real price of liberty is risk. The more risk that the government removes from our lives, the more freedoms we lose. But this isn't about risk. This is about putting your life in the hands of people who are supposed to look out for your interests, and they need to be required to make their passengers put on life jackets with a strobe light when they go across the bar and when they get back into the river. What they do out in the ocean is an altogether different situation. And the sad thing about it is the Coast Guard has this ability, and they'll try to preempt. When you try to do something, the politics, their muddled politics, gets in the way of things. I think the state needs to step forward. The state needs to be the conscience of its community and require this in within the bar and in or out, and you'll save a lot of your constituents.
Thank you, Commissioner Dwyer, and my condolences for your both of your losses. It's you know, I think whether we're crossing one of the bars, and I've done that many, many times in most of the bars in Oregon, or just on the water any time, we get pretty lax sometimes in because we've done it so many times and we don't wear life vests. And I had a very, very good friend who died on the coast 2 months ago, and I was at his funeral, who was a fishing friend of mine for many years, and died on the North Fork Nehalem, where he had lived and fished every day for 20-some years. And again, just never thinking it's going to happen to you. And certainly in this case, under a, you know, professional guide, and there's certain responsibilities there. So thank you very much for testimony. Now, you, Commissioner Dwyer, you said you had one other person, and I see Senator Przanski is here.
Yes, I have Keith, who is the son of one of the persons that drowned, if you'd like to hear.
Okay, well, let's do that and have Senator Przanski come up today,
all right,
as who's the author of the bill. Thank you, Commissioner, both of you.
Thank you.
I think we'll go with Senator Przanski because again, his remarks, and then we'll go into your story.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to let the gentleman go first if you want me to come.
Oh, sure. Well, it's up to you. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Keith Harris. I'm the son of Bill Harris.
Thank you.
I pretty much go along with what everybody else is saying. I just I would have to agree with the way it's stated about what we're asking, that it just be for crossing the bar and reentering the bar. I agree, once you get out in the ocean, that you should be able to do whatever you want. But in the danger zones, which is going back and forth over the bar, I agree that with there needs to be something done by the state to make that mandatory. I really feel that it needs to be done, and that's all I have to say.
Thank you, sir.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As you've heard from the Harris family as well as Commissioner Dwyer, you know, this bill really has resulted from a tragedy to not only this family, but there's other families in this state that have lost loved ones, and also we have individuals that have come to the state maybe with the lack of understanding as to what it really means to be going off land and going into the ocean and crossing these bars to get out there. I understand that there are possible some issues here as to how state law would be impacted or preempted potentially by the federal or U.S. regulations and the Coast Guard. I know that Ms. Atkins is in the process of making some inquiries as to what the authority of the state is. But clearly, if we have the ability and authority to move this bill forward, I'm asking this committee to do so. Not only have you heard from the, I should say, not only based on the testimony you've heard today, but there have been other individuals, in fact, individuals that are employees of on these ships, or these boats, I should say, that are going out, that also have been very relaxed. And even those, I guess I would say, that have the expertise and knowledge that the risk that they have, at some point maybe we as a state do need to step in for a limited purpose, is making certain these safety zones, as Mr. Harris has said, are, you know, we give everyone the best opportunity to be able to come back safe and sound. So what I would ask the committee to do is move Senate Bill 551 forward if we do not have a preemption issue with the federal government. And if we do, I'm wondering if the committee would consider maybe modifying Senate Bill 551 to some type of resolution or some type of statement to the federal government that if we can't take care of the problem in our jurisdictions of the water because we're preempted, that we are asking them to step forward and do so.
Thank you, Senator. Just a couple of questions. First of all, we've talked about this a little bit, but we'll find out what some of the details are with the Coast Guard. Just on a personal point of view, if the committee decides that this is something that we want to go forward with, I'm not opposed to passing it anyway. If the federal government wants to sue us, they can sue us. But I think we have to decide what we think is really good policy. I just had one technical question for you. Do you have the bill in front of you, Senator?
Yes, I do.
On line 11, it says, all boats that carry passengers for hire shall require, and then it goes on about wearing the flotation device. And I know we're thinking of fishing boats. We also have major cruise lines that come across the bar. And I don't think you intend to have the major cruise lines people have to have their 5,000 passengers outfitted with it on. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes. Even though we may be considered wild and crazy in Oregon, I don't think we need to have the cruise ships requiring their passengers. But no, on a very serious note, what we need to do is make certain that we have the right types of boats and those individuals that are on there. And I think for the record, I do need to go ahead and put on the record Floyd Prezonsky, State Senator for District 4.
Thank you. And we can certainly amend that, but I just noticed that. Questions for either of these witnesses? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I feel like you do. I don't really care if we pass something. Let the Coast Guard sue us. I mean, sometimes it's worth that. I think that might force them to do something. But Senator Prezonsky, I'm guessing that what the Coast Guard doesn't like is the idea that we're requiring that each person wear the flotation. I'm wondering if we couldn't, one of the ways we possibly could get around it is require that they make available, when crossing the bar, they make available so we're requiring that they leave with the flotation device and that they make it available somehow. That would probably get the Coast Guard off of our back, as I understand how federal law usually preempts us. And I just thought that might be some kind of way we could do it to get the same result without necessarily having given the Coast Guard an opportunity to throw this out. But like I said, I don't have a problem taking on the Coast Guard on something like that.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, the reason I brought up that point is I think it's just the committee needs to know what potential might be out there. Clearly, it's not that they can preempt us, but they may think they can, and they may be able to by law. The issue I have is whether or not we as a state have a jurisdiction off our bounds, off our lands and into the waterway, and we do for certain purposes. And I know that Ms. Atkins and my office will be working to get clarification. What we've only heard at a very recent time was they thought there may be a problem. But clearly, I think we can make that statement one way or the other as to that we want this to be a priority for the state as well as for the federal government because, even if they are correct, that they may be able to somehow preempt and our law may not have effect, some way we need to get that message out that this is very serious and we need to make certain that individuals are aware of it. I mean, the story we've heard today, here you had an individual that made a conscious decision based on the testimony to actually disregard what even the Coast Guard was saying. And, those type of situations, unfortunately, have to usually be dealt with in other legal means to hold people accountable for that type of conduct. But clearly, I think we as a state, knowing that we want to have individuals come and enjoy the coast and the beach and the waters that we have both inland and out offshore, we should take some precautions, again, in these safety zones. And that is, from my perspective, a reasonable regulation that does not really impinge on someone's personal freedom and liberty. It's just allowing them to, well, not allowing them, it's requiring them to do a certain task but then they can exercise that freedom outside of that area. But in these really treacherous areas, the state has stepped in before in other forums and said certain requirements are going to be required, and this seems to be a simple one that can, in fact, save lives and not impact families, as we've heard today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, then, this bill is for charter only, correct?
Well, the way it's currently written, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, it is written for charter or for hire. I really think it's one of those things that also, in the sense of where we have, I think, an obligation to employees of those employers who actually are going across the bar to go out and let's say, do crabbing or other type of fishery. I think it should apply to them as well. I mean, clearly, ones that are out for hire have an obligation. And if you're distinguishing between those for hire or those for pleasure, meaning they're doing their own, I guess that's one of those risks that we as a decision-making body need to decide on whether that's a policy we want to go or not. But I would say the two areas would be for hire, as the bill calls for. And I also think that we should consider those who are employees that are being put in these situations as to whether or not there should be a requirement for those individuals crossing this this zone of danger.
And the other question I had, when it does say all boats, I don't know if there's definitions regarding size or that might need to go in there. So that would clarify the cruise liners.
Yeah, and I think that's what the chair has referred to, is that we do want to get clarification there, and I agree that we want to make certain that we are, throwing the net out as broad as it needs to be, but not so inclusive that we really are, requiring an exercise that really wouldn't be necessary for safety just because of the simple size of these cruise liner-type boats. Would not be impacted to that type of level.
And then just follow up, like a container ship,
right?
That's
correct.
Is not a
freighter
charter though. Well, yeah, they could be.
Yeah, but I mean freighters. I mean that's the type of stuff that I think that we have other people that are, let's say, more certified smart as to identifying the types of boats that should be included in here as compared to ship, freighters. Cruise liners and stuff like that.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think a freighter would be carrying passengers for hire on a general basis, but cruise ships would. And just one thing, to Senator George's point, the Coast Guard does require that they have flotation devices for each party on the boat currently. So, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Paul Don Hefner, Ken Armstrong, and Brian Rosenauer. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. The Marine Board is fully in support of efforts to promote boating safety consistent with the policy of the state and ORS 83100, which is that it's the policy of the state to promote safety for both persons and property in and connected with the use, operation, and equipment of boats, and to promote uniformity of laws related thereto. And I highlight that phrase, promote uniformity of laws related thereto, because of the issue that you've heard of with Senate Bill 551, that it may run into preemption issues with federal law. And I'll explain that a little later in my testimony for you. To begin with, Oregon's coastal bars, as you've heard, are some of the most dangerous places in the United States, most dangerous waters. They have unique status in the Northwest with the Coast Guard, which has established specific regulations here for coastal bars that allow for closing those areas during certain conditions. During the past 10 years, we've had 3 accidents involving 16 fatalities with charter or guide boats, passengers for hire. And none of the victims in those accidents were wearing a PFD. During that same period, we've recorded 14 recreational boating accidents involving 22 fatalities on Oregon coastal bars, and only 4 of those were wearing PFDs. And I've attached to my testimony tables and a memorandum that outlines those accidents over the past 10 years. But altogether, we've had 38 fatalities during that period on coastal bars involving both recreational and charter or guide types of boats. And Senate Bill 551 addresses the small passenger safety aspect of that. There's no question that PFDs are one of the most important pieces of safety equipment for boating, but they only work when they're actually worn. And almost all coastal bar accidents involve capsizing. There's no time to don a PFD once a boat rolls, even if the PFD is somewhat readily accessible. Add cold water and large breaking waves, and the survivability of those accidents without a PFD is indeed very low. There are several existing Coast Guard regulations that address PFD use on small passenger vessels. The one that seems most related to this bill is 46 CFR 185-508. It requires the master or captain of a small passenger vessel to require his passengers to don life jackets when possible hazardous conditions exist, including but not limited to transiting hazardous bars and inlets. If this regulation was applied, if that federal regulation was applied and used in the case of the Tacky 2, which capsized in Tillamook, or the Sydney May accident, the outcome probably would have changed. The 2003 capsizing of the Tacky 2 on the Tillamook bar was one of the most deadly charter boat accidents in history. 11 persons died, 8 survived. The National Transportation Safety Board investigated that accident and issued a report in 2005. NTSB made recommendations to the Coast Guard, including a recommendation to the Coast Guard that they revise your regulations to require that small passenger vessels operating in Coast Guard designated surf stations and regulated boating areas on the West Coast have all passengers and crew wear life jackets while vessels transit inlets where rough bar warnings are in effect. That's NTSB recommendation MO510. The Coast Guard responded to NTSB's recommendation that it concurred with the intent of the recommendation. However, they stopped short of changing its regulations to make PFD wear mandatory by specifically defining the hazardous condition in their existing regulations to include those periods when a bar warning is posted. Instead, the Coast Guard established a working group that was made up primarily of industry representatives to develop policy and guidance based on risk-based principles. A final report has never surfaced from that working group, and it seems unlikely that a regulatory change is going to happen. At least that's the sense that we have from talking with District 13 of the Coast Guard. So in terms of current federal regulation, the decision to require passengers to don a PFD is still with the captain or the master of the vessel. And this is where SB 551 appears to run into a problem of probable federal preemption. After the Tacky 2 incident and the NTSB report recommendations, we were in close contact with District 13 in Seattle regarding changes to require PFD use on bar crossings. Since several federal regulations address passenger, commercial passenger vessels and PFD use, we were put on notice that state regulation of this area would be subject to federal preemption. This was a couple of years ago. In the Coast Guard's words, and this is most recent, we are almost certain the proposed legislation would be preempted by federal standards, unquote. We've consulted with our Assistant Attorney General on the matter and received informal advice that this concern appears to have some validity because the bill will require what Coast Guard regulations leave to the discretion of the captain in crossing hazardous bars. It's a very frustrating and ironic situation. On the one hand, the Coast Guard, which is the preeminent life-saving and search and rescue organization, refuses to change its regulations to, at a minimum, require PFD wearing when crossing a bar with a rough warning in effect, as recommended by the NTSB. At the same time, they stand in the way of state regulation to enhance the safety of persons crossing bars, where the accident statistics cry out for improvements. And it's very disappointing that the Coast Guard is not taking more of a lead in this area. We, the Marine Board, certainly support the goal of enhancing safety for passengers on coastal bars, However, it would appear that the bill may have preemption issues that need to be addressed. We'd like to suggest that you have your staff and legislative council review that matter before the committee considers moving this particular legislation forward in its current form. If the bill is preempted, perhaps a joint resolution requesting the Coast Guard to amend its regulations for PFD wearing on bar crossings under rough conditions should be considered in order to send a message that the status quo is simply not acceptable. And we believe Oregon's congressional delegation might be helpful in that matter as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I do have one before we move on to Ken, Paul. Help me understand a little bit Marine Board responsibilities and authorities and the Coast Guard. I mean, I'm used to being inland more than I am out there. So what is your scope of authority? Where do you come to this nexus with the Coast Guard in which the Marine Board rules and regulations are required to defer to U.S. Coast Guard regulations?
Mr. Chairman, we have concurrent jurisdiction on many matters with the Coast Guard. Where we have sole authority would be on what's considered sole state waters. These are not navigable waters of the United States. So lakes and reservoirs, we would have exclusive authority to adopt state regulations. On other areas, such as navigable rivers and coastal bays and coastal bars and the territorial sea, we have what's known as concurrent jurisdiction. And so we have essentially parallel regulations with many federal regulations. For example, the carriage of life jackets, the fire extinguishers, equipment, other carriage requirements that are in state law and in state regulations, pretty much parallel federal regulations in that regard. Our numbering system derives its authority from federal law. And on this issue of where we're dealing with commercial passenger safety is where we're kind of treading on that line of who's the big dog.
And who actually, on your boats, as you know, you have to also get a marine license. Is that strictly state or is that federal also in terms of licensing of the vessel?
Mr. Chairman, the federal government delegated that authority to the states under one of the Federal Boat Safety Acts. And so the numbering system that we have where we issue the decals and numbers derives its authority from federal law, but the states carry that out. And that's a prerequisite for some of the federal aid that we receive under boating safety grants.
But do they tell you what the regulations are and what you will license them, or do you have some leeway in terms of how you license vessels?
Mr. Chairman, there's some leeway, but there are certain basic things that need to be the same. The size of the numbers, the state designator, and the types of decal and that. Some of those things have to conform with federal regulations.
I guess the reason I ask, I'm just kind of fishing here, which is appropriate phrase for going out of the bar, is if there is something in terms of this potential preemption issue in which you could have a state citation and subject to loss of your registration of your vessel, if it's done by the state, might be an indirect way to have, if this were to be law, where to give some more added emphasis to someone to make sure that they wore their life vests, even with the Coast Guard issue, if in fact the state has some authority to actually withdraw licensing of the vessel. That's what I'm just kind of thinking out loud.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the one area, as I was listening to the testimony earlier, this particular bill is putting these changes into our PFD statute. However, our board also licenses ocean charter boats. It's a business license that we issue. As a part of it, there are various equipment requirements, which essentially parallel federal requirements. It stems from an accident a number of years ago, the Cougar, which sunk off of Depot Bay in the Central Oregon coast. So we do issue a business license to ocean charter boats in Oregon. We also register guides. Whether something like this could be a condition of that business license, I don't know if that would still run into the same kind of federal preemption, but just trying to think outside the box a little bit, maybe as a business license condition. Yeah. We won't license your vessel unless you agree to require people to perform to the standard or wear a jacket when they're crossing the bar. I don't know if that's just an end run and the Coast Guard would
kick us out. There's more than one way to skin a cat
sometimes.
Senator Jerk?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, maybe you could just walk through for me what the process for the Coast Guard to actually preempt this. So let's take for a hypothetical situation, say we pass this thing. Because a lot of times memorials are just round filed back east. So if we went ahead and passed this, what would be the process for the Coast Guard to undo our state law here? And what would they have to do to get it done?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I'm not exactly sure what that mechanism would be, although I was told a few years back by the Coast Guard that they probably would not sue the state directly. However, if the charter boat captains who aren't here today but don't particularly like this rule for a variety of reasons were to challenge the state law, then the Coast Guard would be obligated to file on their behalf and fight the state as a part of an action that was brought by others, I think, is probably how it might play out.
You know, one thing that's interesting on this is the biggest thing you want to do is you want people to be safe. You want captains, and I, since I have known so many over the years, who are excellent mariners and really, really are very conscientious about taking care of their passengers and their decision making, et cetera. But there's always those few, which is unfortunately why you always regulate. It's always for the few. It's not the majority of people. But one of the advantages of something like this, even with the potential issues that we might have, is a public awareness issue and a public relations issue. I mean, you might technically be able to sue, but it doesn't look very good as your charter business is that you want to sue because they want to make you too safe. And sometimes that can have an impact on getting this job done, regardless of what penalties may be imposed. I think with some of the charter groups, the different organizations who have organizational rules, and if you're a member of this particular group, and these are certain requirements for membership, and if you're going to go fishing on a charter boat, and if you're going to go out with a member of this particular organization, you know they're going to follow certain safety, that becomes a safety marketing issue. And sometimes things like this can help push that. Any other questions?
We tried that angle after the Tacky 2, working with the charter industry to say, well, you know, this would be the best seal of practices, you know, if you have your people put on, for example, an inflatable PFD. They're lightweight, easy to, you don't even know it's on, get the good housekeeping seal as being super safe and market that. They don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we can help push that, though. Any other questions? Okay. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kit Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group, and we're here to say that this is a good bill. We applaud Senator Przanski, also aware that Representative Roblin's working on a similar issue on the other side of the building. I can't really speak to the federal preemption piece. Clearly, that's an issue here, but the fact remains that this is good policy. And the Oregon Ports Group, over half of our members are ports on the Oregon coast, see this as good business, as good policy. Anything that we can do that makes Oregon's waters and bars safer and to Oregonians and visitors, to let people leave with good memories instead of tragic experiences, that's what we're after. The committee talked a little bit earlier this afternoon about that whole issue of how do we bifurcate the vessel size. I think in some of our folks kicking around that notion, somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 foot or 200 gross tons probably gets at the issue of mid-size to larger cruise vessels. I think, Mr. Chair, your response to Senator Montes Anderson's question about the cargo ships, I think they're not covered by this. They're clearly exempt because they don't typically have passengers for hire. But these larger vessels, we obviously don't want to see them get covered under the bill. But for what this is after, we're 100% behind it. And anything that we can do to help, sounds like there may be a little bit of time to work through any clarifications on that as we resolve the federal preemption issue. We just want to add our applause to the chorus. So there you have it. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Any questions? Thank you very much. I think, obviously, we're not going to move this bill regardless at the moment because we would have to make some amendments anyway. But I think the issue and what we do with it is an important one. We have some questions to be answered. I think Senator Prozonsky, I think, can help in finding some issues in terms of the language of some of the issues we brought up today. I know Janet and Paul will see if we get some further clarification of from the Coast Guard and in short order. I think it's also would be valuable to talk to Legislative Council about other alternatives, such as business licensing, et cetera, that might be a way to get at this in case other ways don't work. So those things we'll explore. I'd like to get a sense, though, just at the moment, sense of the committee of this issue and in terms of where it rises, in terms of how you think, in terms of your desires to pursue this on a state level based on what you heard, and just would love to get a few comments from committee members. Senator Decker, what's your general thought?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to do something. I'll leave it in the hands of folks that have worked really hard on this. Between you and Senator Brzezinski and the other folks here, but I'd like to do something. And just mentioning to the three individuals sitting in the back of the room, kind of in the center, it is so nice to have real Oregonians. Not that this building's not populated with real Oregonians, but I've in the last week dealt with a lot of folks who work here in the building, and just walking in and hearing the stories of three people. If you ever wonder if it makes a difference, I can tell you it makes a huge difference to see people who are just trying to make changes to the law to affect others. Obviously, it wouldn't affect you, but it makes a huge difference on us.
Thank you, Senator. Any other thoughts from the committee members?
Mr. Senator Chair, Rosenthal. The fact that the National Transportation Safety Board actually made a recommendation saying that all passengers and crew wear life jackets while the vessels transit inlets where rough bar warnings are in effect. I don't know. I mean, the fact that they made that very recommendation is proof to me that something like this should occur. So I don't know if it would make the Coast Guard feel any better if we put into the bill where rough bar warnings are in effect, because I know that that isn't in the bill. I mean, that would be an option too. But the fact that our National Transportation Safety Board says this indicates to me that we really need to address this issue and get something out.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll continue to pursue this piece of legislation. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 551. We have one more agenda item. You might find this rather interesting. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 492, and we'll wait just a moment for Janet to come back and give us an introduction. I will say, however, for the record, that Ms. Adkins was enthusiastic about possibly having our last public hearing ringside at a cage fight, and I just thought that was rather interesting. I never thought of her as being particularly interested in that topic, but she definitely demonstrated a lot of enthusiasm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it sounds like instead we may go to a high school, which was the next thing on my list of things to do. So.
All right. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about 492, and then we'll begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 492 is at Senator Bates and Prozanski's sponsored the bill, and it would authorize regulation of amateur mixed martial arts events, and it defines mixed martial arts as combative sporting contests between two competitors who use a variety of techniques and holds. And it kind of is a cross between boxing, wrestling, and martial arts. Some of the types of things are one of the types of things is cage fighting. The agency under the state police has authority under professional boxing statutes, they believe, to regulate the professional mixed martial arts, but no clear authority to regulate amateur mixed martial arts. The bill also changes the name of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to the Oregon State Athletic Commission, and it has another number of other requirements to update the statutes. Mr. Chair, one thing I didn't mention in the summary is an increase in the civil penalty authority that's at the top of page 10, from $2,500 to $250,000. Well, that's it. The $2,500 is not much of a deterrent for some of the larger events. And there are representatives of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission and the State Police here after Senator Prozanski.
Okay. So, round two. Senator Prozanski, if you want to come forward.
And Mr. Chair, we may want to go ahead and bring up the end.
Okay. Mr. Darcy and Mr. Hamilton, if you'd like to come forward.
And we'll call Senator Bates.
Okay. And we do have a call out to Senator Bates' office.
Wonderful. If I can start, Mr. Chair, committee members, Floyd Krasomsky, State Senator, Senate District 4. While certified smart people take their seats, I'll just give an intro. I've worked with the state police on numerous issues. This is an issue that came up last summer based on some of the tragic results that have occurred in amateur events. And they approached me as to whether or not we could make some attempts to, let's say, bring in under the control and jurisdiction of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission this opportunity to make certain that individuals who are wanting to participate in these type of amateur events have certain safety protections that unfortunately are not required and cannot be regulated currently. As Ms. Atkins has said, we also are looking at changing the name of the commission into one that's probably what I would consider much more suitable because of the jurisdiction that the commission currently has. And so I told them yes after hearing the stories, and we also, I will just share with you a story that occurred within one of these situations where a young woman who was an amateur who, and from our community of the Eugene-Springfield area, who suffered a tragic outcome because of the these type of events do not really regulate their physical conditioning or really provide for some of the protections that we think that would be already required, including, if I remember correctly, just physicals and making certain these individuals actually are fit enough health-wise to actually be participants in these type of events. I know that Senator Bates was also contacted, and so the two offices have worked together. We know our place in this system, and so we allow the certified smart people to actually take off and run with it, work with legislative counsel. And so I'm really here more to just introduce the subject. As I understand, Senator Bates will also be joining us at some point. And so I give my wholehearted approval and hope that the committee will also realize the need for these changes. And I want to go ahead and comment on one part, and that's the increase for the type of penalties. It may seem significant. It is significant, and there's a reason for that. If you think about the promoters in these type of events, that's the cost of doing business right now. They can suck up easily a $2,500 fine and maintain these type of events without taking the precautions and requirements. We need to make certain that we get compliance, and that's why you're seeing such a significant increase being recommended. So we will, in fact, make certain that those who want to promote these type of events actually will heed to the warnings, and without really tying back into the last bill that we heard, but Senate Bill 551. I think this kind of, you can actually have a segue between the two bills as to where you have an individual who is out for hire that basically put a lot of people at jeopardy and risk, and unfortunately had tragic results. This is one of these situations that we can take this the steps within the state to make certain for those who want to be a participant have certain, understandings as to the responsibilities for those who are promoting these events to make certain those who are participants are able to participate without causing grave health risk to them. So with that, Mr. Chair, unless there's some questions, I'm scheduled to be in judiciary, and I told them I'd be running late, but I probably need to be up there.
Thank you very much, Senator Prozanski. We'll excuse you. Senator Bates has arrived, so I'll ask Senator Bates to come up, and then before we go to our two witnesses. Thank you very much, Senator.
Senators here. Yeah.
Welcome, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Senator Metzger, Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Senator Alan Bates, and as most of you know, I'm a family physician who practices in Southern Oregon. I have a bit of a prepared testimony, but I'll give you a few thoughts first. We've come a long ways from bare-knuckle boxing of the last century when people would fight almost to the death. And a lot of that is a result of the progress made as a result of having a boxing commission that regulates and promotes, but also makes these type of fighting as safe as possible. I sometimes think of boxing and cage fighting as testosterone run wild, but that's my personal opinion, and I'm going to try to keep that out of this. I know there's many people who love to box and fight, and in fact, at one point I did in my life, and you see the results, so we won't go there. Okay. Let me first explain how I got involved in this issue. In late 2006, I had a constituent call who expressed concern about her son. Her son had recently participated in a local cage fight, and the promoter had promised her that there was little chance that he would lose or be seriously injured. I'm not quite sure how he guaranteed her son wouldn't lose or why she was interested, but that was the case. After he lost against a larger and stronger 14-year-old, her 17-year-old son was hospitalized with head trauma. The organizers of the fight had promised the parents that the kids would be protected and that the event would be run with caution. That simply didn't happen. The parents felt very misled. They were told one thing and something else actually occurred. I would say in the face of it, 14 and 17-year-olds in cage fights, in a situation where there was no supervision from a commission, is in itself a difficulty we need to solve here. Bloody bouts are a regular occurrence of cage fight events, and the risk of contamination and spread of blood-borne disease are high. For the health and safety of the competitors and of the audience, we need the experience and authority of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to oversee these amateur and professional cage fights. When there is blood in the ring, there's a risk of competitors spreading hepatitis B, C, and to a much lesser extent, HIV and other blood-borne diseases. This is a serious public health concern, and the Boxing and Wrestling Commission needs to have the authority to oversee these competitions, just like they already do with professional cage fights and boxing matches. Simply stated, competitors and promoters need protection that don't exist in current statute. Of course, when athletic competitions take place, there's always a risk of injury. We recognize that. But when the sport is a full contact, as mixed martial arts is, competitors need additional protection for their health and safety. As a result, I worked together with Senator Prozanski and Brad Darcy, who I've talked on the phone with and just met today. Thank you. The Boxing and Wrestling Commission developing the bill that is before you today. We believe that Senate Bill 492 will bring more fairness to bouts in Oregon and provide medical safety and protection to its competitors. I obviously am most concerned about the medical safety and protection in this bill. I would like to applaud the work of Brad Darcy and the Boxing and Wrestling Commission for the work on this issue. I look forward to any questions you have. Frankly, most of the heavy lifting this was done by Brad and his commission. I think they put together a good solution to this problem. I would hope you would look at it favorably and pass it out with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Questions for Senator Bates? Mr. Darcy. And I don't have the list in front of me. So just
all right. Really appreciate it. Mr. Chair, I have to go back to committee. Could I be excused?
Let's take a vote on that.
I should have asked.
Thank you very much, Senator Bates.
Thanks for the time.
I'm glad you worked on this issue. It's a new and emerging problem, I think, in Oregon.
I think it really is. I don't know about the rest of the state. In Southern Oregon, this is an extremely popular sport now.
You see the signs up and down I-5 now promoting, and yeah. You wonder... You're hoping someone's keeping an eye on what's going on.
I'm especially concerned about teenage kids doing this, and I look forward to seeing this become law. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you. Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name's Bob Hamilton. I live just west of Bend in the mountains. I'm a retired assistant attorney general. I spent 24 years in the Attorney General's office, 22 of them running the organized crime section for six Oregon Attorney Generals. And when I retired, I had a little time on my hands, and I had been a boxing fan for years. Used to watch it with my dad. And I had gotten completely disgruntled with boxing. It was a mess. And I think, corrupt and so forth. And I didn't watch it for years. And then a few years ago, I saw a change in some of the network coverage. And more importantly, I heard of a move by Senator McCain in Congress to establish a National Boxing Commission to reform boxing once and for all. So I thought if I could get on the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission just as a fan, that I might be in a position to, in some small way, enhance that likelihood. So I got on this Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and it's quite a cast of characters and an interesting situation without a lot of activity, quite frankly. Several years later, by longevity, I got elected chair of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. And the following week, I learned, of course, that Senator McCain's bill had failed in the House of Representatives in Congress after having passed the Senate. And so I was, my initial motivation was gone. But we learned a few things over the years as matters evolved in Oregon with boxing and wrestling, and we had a modest amount of activity. I must say that I also am here representing a former Portland newsman, Doug Lemire, who is a commissioner, and a former senator, Senator Len Hannon, who's a commissioner, and the other member of the commission, Ted Molinari. No one that I know of got on the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission, had ever heard the term mixed martial arts, had ever seen one of these events, nor were they fans of it. But what happened is, as the years went by, we had been trying to get control over an activity, a boxing activity called tough guy fights. You may have seen these advertised over the years. They're in armories. They're like a college smoker. They're terrible. They pretend to be amateurs. They've fallen through the cracks of our regulation. And we were trying to ban them. They were doing horrible things. They didn't have any doctors at ringside. If any of you are familiar with boxers' hands, it's an intricate art to wrap them so with gauze. And in these tough guy fights, they're slapping adhesive tape straight on the knuckles. They're making a weapon instead of protecting the hand. We had reports of people getting what were obviously concussions in the ring, just being pushed off the apron to get on to the next fight. No medical people in attendance, no ambulances. The reason this is important is that we tried to regulate it. We went to get a temporary restraining order here in Salem against one of the upcoming operations, and we failed. The flaws and the holes in our statutes were pointed out to us. And basically, in a nutshell, it was, you can only ban no-holds-barred fighting. So if they banned one thing, it was legal. And we failed. This made us wary and very aware of the limits of our statutes and the antiquated nature of our statutes. When mixed martial arts emerged in Oregon at the professional level initially, we warily tried to ban it. We were fining for unlicensed activity. We were building up a series of cases all along knowing that because of our efforts at mixed martial arts, that we may be on a fool's errand and wasting taxpayers' money, but we were not fans of this particular activity. After a while, the major proponents of the professional mixed martial arts in a group came to one of our commission meetings and basically said, "We're good people. Do you really know anything about our sport? We're former Olympic athletes. One of them from Portland area was a gold medalist in the Olympics in Greco-Roman wrestling. Another one of them that if you wanted to spend $40 on pay-per-view tonight or a Saturday night, you could watch him in an ultimate fighting championship for the national title of the UFC, a guy named Randy Couture. Very, very famous fellow in this." And they said, "This is a sport. Let us convince you. And most importantly, they said, "We will submit any regulations, any rules that you promulgate." We said, will you submit to rules akin to the state of Nevada, which has had a lot more experience with these sorts of sports than we have? They agreed. We did rules. They cleared up all their old fines and all of the regulatory activity. And I have to say that to this day, and this has been, I didn't get a chance to do my due diligence on this. I found out about this last night, spent this morning driving here. We haven't had any trouble with the pros. We've licensed them. Brad will tell you in a minute, they're packing people in all over the state of Oregon. But we do need our statutes changed, I think, to more clearly give us the authority for this ongoing regulation of the professionals. We'd like to clear up any ambiguities in these tough guy fights. But the big problem, and it is a big problem, and both senators have talked about it, is this: what has spawned from the pros is this amateur stuff. It is totally unregulated. It is crazy. It is dangerous, and it's going on everywhere. I don't remember which was the first incident that we became aware of. It may have been when a kid broke his back, had to have his, could have been paralyzed over in John Day in one of these matches. The incident, and Brad will go into these in greater detail. And so it was a no-brainer that we had to do something to come into you this session of the legislature. Quite frankly, the thing that was of more concern is, what do we do in the meantime until we can get into the legislature and pass this problem on to you? And because we have the ability to set bonds, we have been using the limits of that authority on the amateurs to try to bring some semblance of regulation to their activities. If the professionals have one of these things you see advertised, you'll see 12 bouts or 13. Two or three or four of those will be professionals. We won't show up. Brad won't authorize the referees, the judges, the inspectors, and so forth, unless all of the fights on that card meet, whether they're amateur or pro, meet our standards. Doctors on standby, ambulances, et cetera, et cetera. So we have impacted, to some extent, the amateur activity by the promoters that do both. They have been... I can't think of an incident, and maybe we can ask Brad, of where they haven't genuinely done their best to comply with all our rules and regulations. The problem are the 100% amateur shows. We can show up to get a piece of the ticket sales by a head count, and we can set a bond. And between us, we have done everything under our authority to try to keep a lid on this until we could get this bill before you. The punchline is, this bill modernizes our statute. It gives us the authority over the amateurs. It changes the name, because last session, wrestling is now called entertainment wrestling, where it should be. Thankfully, was taken from our jurisdiction. And basically, we review who promote the fights, but we don't have the doctors and other regulations in the blood test, because, as we all know, entertainment wrestling is for entertainment. My punchline is, the status quo is dangerous. Hopefully something can be done. If you haven't seen mixed martial arts, and none of us knew about it or were fans of it before it started, and basically were skeptics, I'd make a few comments. One is, there's more sport involved in it than you might think. The real successful competitors have seemed to me mostly to come from the ranks of amateur wrestlers who are world-class athletes, Olympic champions, with nowhere to go pro. And they have tended to dominate the sport because they're world-class wrestlers, and then they pick up a little boxing and a little judo and a little grappling, and they've been very successful. But whether or not I'm a fan of it, or Brad is, or any of us are, it's extraordinarily popular. It is exploding everywhere. if we are given the authority to regulate it, we have a companion bill that has some revenue aspects to it because we simply don't have the people to do it. And once again, my punchline is the status quo is dangerous, and I think Mr. Darcy, who came to the Boxing and Wrestling Commission from Chinook Winds with a vast amount of experience in boxing, I'm not sure much in mixed martial arts either, but he's the best thing that's happened in the boxing and wrestling world for us in the last several years. I'd, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions, but if...
Just real quick.
Senator Moss-Anders has a question, then we'll go to Mr. Darcy's testimony.
Okay. First, before I ask my question, I want to welcome the Gresham Chamber that is sitting observing this. Welcome. Will this include those fights that we are hearing and reading about that occur in high school, off high school premises with the youth that they're starting to have? I don't know what kind of fights they're called, but they're...
There was a... Mr. Chair, Senator Manas Anderson, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, you are.
I think you're referring to that cult... cultural thing that was in a movie, this Fight Club stuff. That
I didn't go to movies,
is,
but
I didn't go to that one. But there was a movie that it was kind of bare knuckle, no holds barred sort of fighting that kind of got I don't know what kind of a following. That is not what we're talking about legalizing. And these are organized events. Tickets are sold. People, even running amateur events, make money, although they don't pay the participants. So these are organized events.
You.
I believe that would be wholly illicit as far as we're concerned.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Darcy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Brad Darcy. I currently serve as the Executive Director of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and it's my pleasure today to be speaking today in support of Senate Bill 492. The Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission has now been serving Oregonians for 20 years. During that time, the commission has undergone a number of changes to adapt to new circumstances. House Bill 492 will serve to make our controlling statutes reflect the current scope of our responsibilities and activities. The commission's mission remains the same, but the kinds of activities we find ourselves regulating have shifted to a point not contemplated in our original statutes. Our goal with Senate Bill 492 is to update the authorizing statutes of the Commission to more closely reflect the active trends in the industry we regulate and give us sound authority under which to operate. The role of the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission is to protect the public and the participants involved in regulated ring sports. Traditional ring sports include boxing and wrestling. Regulatory activities of the Commission include the enforcement of health and safety standards for the conduct of competitive events. We work diligently to minimize the inherent risks in combative sports. The commission is made up of a 5-member volunteer board that is appointed by the Oregon State Police Superintendent. The commission member's primary responsibility is to promulgate rules for regulation. In recent years, we have seen the addition of a whole new ring sport promotion commonly known as mixed martial arts. Mixed martial arts is also referred to as ultimate fighting or cage fighting. Mixed martial arts is a sport that combines elements of different fighting styles, including boxing, kickboxing, and grappling. Its original premise was to pit different fighting styles against each other in a no-holds-barred format to see which style was the most effective. The response by many state commissions, including this one, like Mr. Hamilton mentioned, was to work to prohibit these contests from happening. The promoters of these events realized they had a viable product, but could not operate without the establishment of rules acceptable by major athletic commissions. As rules were accepted by commissions like New Jersey and Nevada, the sport began to gain widespread and mainstream acceptance. Mixed martial arts has exploded in popularity. Fight fans in Oregon have particularly embraced this new sport. The addition of mixed martial arts has elevated commission activity to an unprecedented level. The Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission began licensing promoters of mixed martial arts in 2004. In 2004, three promoters conducted 18 mixed martial arts shows. In 2005, six promoters conducted 31 mixed martial arts shows. In 2006, nine promoters conducted 72 mixed martial arts shows throughout the state. To date, mixed martial arts shows have been conducted in Portland, Gresham, Salem, Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, Roseburg, Medford, Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, Bend, Redmond, Prineville, Pendleton, John Day, Coos Bay, and the Dalles. In comparison, the state of Nevada held 20 mixed martial arts events in the same period. These include shows that take place in armories and fairgrounds with several hundred attendees to Rose Garden events with thousands in attendance. The ticket receipts of these events usually range from $10,000 to $70,000. These promotions are beginning to create an economic impact on local communities. Senate Bill 492 is one part of our strategy in dealing with this increase in activity. A primary effect of Senate Bill 492 will be to provide the Commission with the authority to regulate amateur mixed martial arts promotions. Currently, the Commission has the authority to regulate the conduct of professional mixed martial arts promotions and bouts. Our statutes do not provide the authority of the Commission to regulate events that promote strictly amateur competitions. Of the 72 mixed martial arts shows conducted in 2006, 19 of those promotions were within the scope of the Commission's current regulatory authority. The promoters of amateur shows are able to promote these amateur fight shows without regulation in place. The Commission's goal is to acquire the authority to provide regulatory oversight for these fight shows so that we can enforce some basic standards for health and safety. Without the passage of Senate Bill 492, amateur mixed martial arts shows will continue to be free to operate with no restrictions. The Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission is working hard to meet its original mission to provide effective regulation of commercially driven ring sport promotions. Senate Bill 492 provides the Commission an opportunity to continue meeting that mission. I thank the committee for your time, and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Darcy. Would you explain a little bit the medical advisory committee that's in the bill on page 7?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Historically, the change we've made there, historically the commission has always had as a member one physician as a requirement. And the role of that physician member was to provide to the commission medical advice as we create rules and health standards. The challenge that we're trying to meet has been one of getting licensed physicians to serve as ringside physicians and members of the commission. The challenge is that the liability that these ringside physicians assume is fairly great. They are making decisions that affect whether a fighter can participate in an event. And like most professions, they want to be compensated for that assumption of liability. We've had a difficult time of getting physicians to do this and serve, and what the intent of that change is to allow people to serve on this committee. We have the benefit of that advice, but also let them operate as ringside physicians as well.
And then their compensation is paid out of wherever the purse is of this event.
Correct. They would basically be like another official assigned by the commission, being paid directly by the promoter for their activities.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually invited to a party one time where we had a pay-per-view subscription to one of these things, and found it not a very tasteful thing to watch. But nonetheless, apparently a lot of my friends do, but I couldn't find the appeal.
What kind of friends?
Exactly. I got two specific questions in the bill that are of a little concern to me, so I'll go over. Page 10. The amount of the civil penalty goes from $25,000 to $250,000. There are times I understand that the agency or the department would like to work with people that are of substantial means. But at the same time, we don't want to create market barriers to people who are willing to comply with your rules. And I could see somebody who is a startup promoter who is willing to comply with all your rules but could not find somebody who would stand behind a $250,000 potential civil penalty, even though they're trying to comply with the rules. If there's a problem, they get fined. And when I was looking at your testimony, the ticket receipts of these events usually range from $10,000 to $70,000, which means you're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 5 to 10 times the amount of the receipts. And so it seems like to me this could be a market barrier to startup promoters to challenge some of these larger institutional ones. And to be perfectly honest with you, I really am nervous when civil penalties and those kind of things become market barriers to competition. If you could comment on that, I'd really appreciate it. And would you be open to an amendment to the bill that would lower that to some level that would be attainable for most startup promoters?
Senator George, the fine is comparable nationally to commissions that you're exactly right that the majority of the events that we oversee don't meet generally the scale that some of the other commissions would be regulating. There's potential, though, for that. We have national level promotions come here. By and large, to answer your question, I would be open to that. And the reason for that is because, by and large, most of the promotions fall in that range that you just mentioned. However, the fines on some level do need to serve as a deterrent for someone that does, you know, we've had boxers here going to leave town with $4 or $5 million, and promoters that are going to get something comparable to that based on the promotion they make. And so, you know, if we're going to tell a promoter that, or someone that's going to make millions of dollars, you need to comply with this rule or you're going to be subject to a $2,500 fine, that won't serve as an adequate deterrent. If $250,000, there's nothing magical about that number. You mentioned market barrier. That's been a thread that we've been trying to weave through this whole process, because in a lot of ways this is a new industry from nothing. There are my chairman Hamilton mentioned Randy Couture and then another gentleman, Matt Lindland. These people that are making these promotions, this is something they created from nothing, and we have a respect for that. This is an economic opportunity for some people, and it's something we're trying to keep cognizant of, to not place unnecessary restrictions on those opportunities. But at the same time, have to have the tools available to do our job too in terms of enforcement.
If I could follow up on that one. I guess I'll take this yes. So, I was noticing that you guys take a certain percentage of the gate receipts, and I think what I'd be more comfortable with on 10, if it's workable with you guys, is to say that there's a stair step fine, but the larger the take, maybe the higher the potential penalty could be. And is that workable? Let's say, for instance, one of these big televised pay-per-view type thing. Are you guys able to tap into those dollars or tap into those resources and make the fine compatible with the total take of the event? Is that a possibility?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, historically, the commission did tax pay-per-view revenues, and that was a major source of our funding. Since I believe it was 2001, there was a tax court case that now prohibits us from doing that.
And I'm talking about the civil penalty. Do you track that? Mm-hmm. Could you hook the civil penalty to the amount of the total take of the gate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator,
that's what I was asking.
I agree with what you're saying. Make it scalable to the level of the event. I think that's a concept from a policy standpoint that I know I might be agreeable to. It's something the commission could consider. I think there's some prudence to that.
Go ahead. Yeah. You have another comment on that? Okay.
Yes, Senator. Senator George, it seems like when we have a boxing event, it's been a big one. Roy Jones, who filled the Rose Garden, was the pound-for-pound best fighter in the world and fought for the undisputed light heavyweight championship of the world against a guy from England, HBO, you name it, huge gate. He had a deal with Nike, is why he was here. And that's what we're trying to do, is nothing against them. But the next big one we had was Floyd Mayweather, who currently is the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world, and he didn't have much of an opponent. But then you get to the mom-and-pop operation down in Roseburg. So we are fully amenable to any changes like that. But we do need to recognize the disparity,
sure,
in some of these gates. And so we're open to anything like that. It's just the current thing
Sure. Doesn't get there.
For the big-time guys, it's just, it's laughable.
If I could, one last thing. The only other thing, that, and this is sort of a philosophical thing, over the last 15 or so years down here at the Capitol, there's been the tendency in state statute to allow agencies and departments to set fees by rule. And it's been a growing concern that I have a problem with. And it, on page 4, and I think there's some other mention in here, page 4 and line 17, your rules, currently your annual license fees are established by rule also. And I was wondering if it would be possible for us to put those fees into statute so that there's a little more legislative oversight over a commission like what we're talking about here. I mean, this is a fast-moving commission, and there's a lot of changes in it. I'd like to see perhaps the legislature to have a little bit more control over those fees and what's happening. And that would be the only thing I'd say that would be my other comment. Those are my only two concerns. Otherwise, I think it's really important that we do regulate this.
Chair Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, you said that entertainment wrestling is now not under your purview. Is that correct?
Chairman Musker, Senator Monis Anderson, the conduct of entertainment wrestling, and by that I mean we're not regulating, we're not licensing the performers, we're not enforcing rules for how they conduct their shows. They are the primary responsibilities for a wrestling promoter is to, they have to be licensed, they have to provide a corporate surety bond, and they have to pay a tax against the gross receipts of their events.
Because I know that in Section 2 on page 3, you did mention entertainment wrestling, and I understood that that wasn't under your purview, but thank you. That clarifies that question. But why are you changing the Oregon State Boxing and Wrestling Commission to Oregon State Athletic Commission? Because athletic, to me, includes basketball and football and everything else. So doesn't this muddy the waters a little bit by changing the name?
We don't just, Senator Metzger, Senator Monis Anderson, we don't regulate wrestling anymore. So there's one reason. We don't just regulate boxing anymore. And this is kind of the name that's common around the country. It's the New York State Athletic Commission. It's the Nevada State Athletic Commission. Those are the regulatory agencies that do this in the various states. So we have tried to fit ourselves into what is the most common practice, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's at least in the boxing circles, it's understood.
Any questions? Just Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a few years ago, we had outlawed, I guess for a brief period of time, ultimate fighting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking through the documents, and I read about this case in John Day where this individual, obviously, well, he was air-flighted to Boise, to a hospital in Boise. And so this feels and looks like, and I guess my question is somewhat philosophical, is in a civilized society, you had this incredible, it seems like kid, he was 18 or 19 years old, that seemed like beloved in the community, never done this before. And I'm just having a hard time thinking, in a civilized society, why we would put a 19-year-old in a cage, he had no insurance, and boom, 2 minutes into the match, he's on an airplane to Boise, and the rest of his life has changed. And that just leads me to, why do we allow, I know we had banned, outlawed ultimate fighting, why would we allow, even if you're there and a doctor's there, it's helpful, but why would we allow this 19-year-old from Grant High School that everyone seemed to love so much to get in a cage and change his life in 10 minutes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckert, it's a question we deal with every day on some level or not. And the initial effort of the commission was to prohibit, and at the time, statutorily, we categorize it as extreme fighting. And what the definition was basically a no-holds-barred fight with no accepted rules. And that concept has really gone by the wayside in terms of what we're talking about now. This, I'm not an apologist necessarily for the sports that we're talking about, and I try not to be. Our role is to basically provide a structure around an allowable activity that minimizes the inherent risks that exist. On a moral level, you know, it does, those questions do come to mind all the time, and I think in some cases like that one, it makes you think even more about that. But in terms of the moral dilemmas that presents, our approach to that is to try and minimize the risk of these allowable activities.
Yeah. Senator, may I comment too?
Yeah.
Senator Metzger, Senator Decker, that was a pure amateur bout in John Day. That event was one of the impetus for us to we knew we were coming in here to try to get legislation, but that was the impetus for what do we do in the meantime. This amateur stuff is novel. There is no standard to go by. How young do you allow it? It may be your call in allowing us to regulate the amateur stuff, that you put some threshold that, you know, you have to be 15 or you have to be the age disparity, the size disparity, so forth. There may be some limits. Ultimate fighting is not per se illegal in Oregon. Ultimate fighting is the name of one of the mixed martial arts federation. Ultimate fighting, you have these pride fighting people, you have the International Fight League. Some of this goes on in cages, some of it doesn't. If we are given the authority to regulate, as similar to boxing, you try to not have mismatches. You have civilized, you have much more civilized combat. You have better referees. If there is ever an events that need good referees, it's far more critical. So what you try to do through the regulation is to see that the risk of this kind of injury is minimized, and that the skill level are the same, and so forth. We have not made a moral judgment, and whether that's because of the limits on our statutory authority or not is up to each commissioner. I can only echo what Mr. Darcy said. This is not my favorite cup of tea.
So, Mr. Chair, and this is obviously not for the panel, but this is for us. I do make a moral judge. I mean, we're not restricted, obviously. And to me, putting 15-year-olds, allowing 15-year-olds in a cage, maybe it's the distinction between professional and amateur. There's just not too many places I wouldn't go in this activity to limit or ban or certainly regulate. But to me, I think of a civilized society and throwing 15-year-olds in a cage and letting them beat on each other with no, to me, it's just not what I think of. So I'm not sure where the chair wants to go, but probably can't get too far along, at least in this. And I went to the Roy Jones match, and when you talked about gauzing up, to me that's just a completely different experience altogether, that and what I'm reading about here.
Thank you, Senator. Well, actually, you brought up a very good question, and Senator Decker added to that. Is there any age limitation for any of these amateur fights?
Mr. Chairman, as Chairman Hamilton mentioned before, we have, with flimsy authority, asserted as much influence on the promoters right now to not allow minors to participate in these shows. Basically, what we've done is said, if you're going to allow this, your bond will be, for all intents and purposes, a prohibitive amount. They're required to come up with this surety bond to have a license. And that's I'm not sure if that would withstand a challenge right now or not, to be perfectly honest. And this authority that we're asking for would then give us the authority to clearly state that minors, I personally don't think there's any room for minors to be part of these promotions. I don't think a minor can assume legally that kind of risk. If you're an adult, at least you can legally assume a certain measure of risk. Can I, as a parent, assume that kind of risk on behalf of my child? I don't. I guess I tend to agree with Senator Deckert. I just don't think it's because the amateur component of mixed martial arts is so similar in format to the professional. And by that I mean, if you drew a comparison in boxing, in amateur boxing, amateurs wear headgear, they wear bigger gloves, the rounds are shorter, there is a structure around that to make sure that they're in with comparable skill level, weights, you know, all that kind of stuff. There are very few differences in the mixed martial arts world between an amateur competition and professional in terms of the rules and what they're doing. If you go to, like Mr. Hamilton mentioned a minute ago, a show that has both amateurs and pros, you would have a hard time knowing without knowing which of the fights were amateurs and which were pros, because they're doing the same thing. And so that's, I guess, to answer your question, under a regulated environment, I would work very hard to prohibit minors from participating in these programs.
Okay. So I just want to make sure I understand. When you talk about minor, you're talking about 18. And you have flimsy authority, what you're saying, so it's not really clear. So there may be people under the age of 18 that may participate, but you try to use whatever tools you have, bond authority, et cetera, to encourage behavior otherwise. Well, it's interesting. In looking and reading over what you're trying to do, first of all, I appreciate what you're trying to do, what you're trying to find some regulation into something right now that is just a total free-for-all, I mean, literally, and in this particular element. And so trying to bring something under regulation and some safe forms of safety is the right way to go. So I really applaud you for that. Then we go to what Senator Decker is talking about is, okay, regulation is great, but we ask the broader question is, should it be allowed at all, or at least a certain age group period? I mean, whether it's 18 or 21 or should there be something in which it's just not allowed, amateur or otherwise, until certain age requirements where people can make those types of decisions. I mean, that is a question of just what we think is proper, and then and whatever that age is, then make sure you have the authority to properly regulate it. I think the point that Senator George brought up, I thought, is excellent, and that you're receptive to in terms of trying to find a way to tier these fines is proper. So these major events, it isn't, a price of doing business. It's hefty, but for smaller events that, it's not a hammer that is outrageous. Any other questions by the committee or thoughts by the committee on just some of the general principles we're talking about today?
Well, not necessarily the principles. I'm seeing that you get the commission gets a dollar for every ticket that's sold. Is that correct? Is that how I read it correctly in the statute?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monis Anderson, that's relatable just to boxing. And I'm trying to remember the year. Years ago, we basically set up what's referred to as our amateur fund. And at professional boxing matches, each ticket that's sold, there's a dollar payable to the commission that goes into a fund that helps support amateur boxing.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, obviously, first of all, there's a couple of things we would want to work on in terms of amendments to the bill. Based on some of our conversation today, I think I'd like to circle around with some of the members and also talk about some of the other issues that we had in terms of how we might move forward. I do believe that you need to have, if we're going to continue along this line, you need to have better authority, which you're attempting to get here, and I certainly concur with that. So we'll talk to members about any other limitations on the participation that they would like to have, and then try to draw up an authority with appropriate fines that the committee is scheduled, a matrix of some kind that the committee is comfortable with, and try to move forward for you. If there's no other questions, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 492. And Janet, anything for the good of the order before we adjourn?
No, Mr. Chair. We have been talking about the March 16th date, and that potentially is going to be at Milwaukee High School in Portland for a hearing on several bills.
So that would be 2 weeks from Friday. We're looking at, I think, an 11-2 committee hearing. And I had Janet look in that general area, since all of our committee is from the general metro area. I won't send you 400 miles away. But that way it would be close by with everyone and still have an opportunity to have some participation. And we're looking at some bills that might be particularly interested to people in high school age and get them involved in our discussion. Okay. So with that, we're adjourned.